Earlier this month, the Globe and Mail published a series of articles aimed at reopening the debate about healthcare reform in Canada. Calling Canada's system ailing, failing, and torn apart at the seams, the Globe's writers argued throughout the series that healthcare costs are ballooning out of control and that the only option is private, for-profit healthcare. While the Globe was raging on about doom and gloom of our system, the Toronto Star published an op-ed by Dr. Michael Rackliss, a health policy analyst and an associate professor at the University of Toronto, who brought good news about Canadian Medicare. Today, on the Health Justice Radio Collective, we'll be talking to Dr. Rackliss, and we hope he'll share his good news with us.
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
We have Dr. Michael Rackliss. He's a health policy analyst and an associate professor at the University of Toronto. Dr. Rackliss, are you there?
Yes, good afternoon, Nikki.
Good afternoon. So can you tell us a little bit about this good news for Medicare that you were talking about in the Toronto Star?
I guess partly it was in somewhat perverse reaction to the Globe series and other doom and gloom stories about our health system. So there were a couple of pieces of good news I cited. One is that healthcare expenses as a share of our overall economy, which is the best indication of the affordability of our healthcare system, had actually gone down with the most recent data that was released 3 weeks ago by the Canadian Institute for Health Information. And overall, I think that there's a good case to be made that while healthcare costs have risen slightly in the last 5 to 10 years, there is no crisis of sustainability. And the other piece of good news I noted was that although the Globe series did include one story about innovations in the public system, the focus was overwhelmingly on the private system, with a 5,000-word article one day following Dr. Brian Day through his private Vancouver Cambie Surgical Clinic. And so the good news that I highlighted was that in both Alberta and Saskatchewan in the last couple of months, there have been cases where the public system has been held up as more efficient than the private system. In Alberta, the Alberta Health Services Board, which funds services, health services in Alberta, took a contract away from a private surgical facility in Calgary, the Health Resource Center, and gave it to a public ambulatory facility on the campus of the Foothills Public Hospital. And then in Saskatchewan, when the government was attempting to contract out some services in the Regina area, the QP in Regina took the Regina Health Region to an arbitrator, claiming that, in fact, the services that they'd contracted out were more expensive to provide, and the arbitrator ruled in their favor that, in fact, the health region's costing methodology had been faulty, and the services would be cheaper to provide out of a public clinic, even if the Regina Health Region had to build a new one from scratch. So I felt that those were just a couple of pieces of good news about our healthcare system that we don't normally hear about.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch on something you mentioned at the beginning. The Globe series really described healthcare as crowding out other social services, as eating up money for education, and they quoted figures from the TD economic statement that warned that healthcare would account for 80% of the provincial budget by 2030. Where do these numbers come from, and is healthcare really devouring our social service budget?
No, I would say that it isn't, and in fact, of course, it's very difficult to describe a graph on radio. but when we look at healthcare, if we look at what provinces spend for healthcare in Canada, which is about 65% or plus of our health budget, 30% of health spending in Canada is private, mainly for drugs, dental services, and optical services. And a tiny percent of public spending goes through other than provincial governments, mainly workers' compensation boards and other such organizations. So if we just look at provincial health care spending, because that's been the focus of the rhetoric, as you mentioned, that provinces can't afford education or in social services because they're being eaten up by their health systems. In Canada as a whole, health spending by provinces used to be about 33% of their program spending, which means that's their overall budgets minus their debt payments. So it used to be about a third of what Canadian provinces spent on programs up until the late 90s. Then in the late 90s, moving into this past decade, healthcare costs did rise, and now in 2003 they were consuming 39% of provincial program spending, but that figure has been completely flat for the last 6 years. So the first point is that that healthcare spending as percent of what provinces spend on programs across Canada has been completely flat for the last 6 years. Secondly, it had rose from sort of low 30% to high 30%, and mainly because governments cut other programs such as social services, environment, housing, etc., not because healthcare costs particularly were out of control. So if you look at overall provincial spending in Canada over the last 20 or 30 years, it reached a peak in the early 1990s during the last recession, and then has been plummeted for the next 10 to 15 years, and then was rising slowly the last few years. But what provincial governments spend on all their programs is still less now than it was at its peak in 1992. So a way of explaining that healthcare is not eating everybody else's lunch, perhaps, is tell the story of if an epidemic sweeps through a community and kills one of the children in the family. A few months later, the father looks across the table at the one remaining kid and says, "Sonny, we can't afford you anymore. You're no longer sustainable. You used to eat only a quarter of the food in this house, but now you're eating a third of this food in this house, and before you know it, it'll be half, and there won't be room for anybody else." And, of course, the poor kid is eating exactly as he's always been eating. It's just that there are only three people in the family now instead of four because his brother passed away. So in a similar fashion, particularly in Ontario in the 90s, the late 90s, we killed off the Ministry of the Environment. We got Walkerton. We killed off the Ministry of Housing, and we've got terrible homelessness. People on social assistance in Ontario are only getting 60% of what they were getting in 1995, which wasn't adequate then. So healthcare spending has risen slightly as a share of provincial expenditures. It's not the apocalyptic scenario that TD Bank has outlined by any means, and it's only gone up as little as it has because other government programs have been cut, and overall the size of government is actually smaller now than it was in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm. In the Globe, they also quote John Manley, president and CEO of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, saying that Canada has the second most expensive health system in the world in terms of GDP. Is that true?
No, it's false. I'm not sure exactly why Manley said that. However, it could be related to the fact that up until recently, the Fraser Institute used to say that all the time, too. The most recent international spending data that we've got, and I should mention that I hope that you'll let your listeners know about my website, and I do have a couple of recent slide presentations with all these graphs on them at my website. And the latest international data we've got, which unfortunately is 2 years old, 2008, shows that that Canada was actually sixth. And when you look at the international list, what's striking immediately is the U.S. is spending way more than anybody else. In that year, they spent 16% of their economy on healthcare. Number two was France at 11.2%. And Canada was sixth at 10.4, but there really isn't that much difference, between the second group of 12 countries, going from Sweden at 9.4% to France at 11.2%, and Canada in the middle at 10.4%. So now, what the Fraser Institute used to do is they used to say, well, Canada is a relatively young country, the European countries are older, healthcare on average is consumed more by older people than younger people. So let's age adjust the healthcare cost data. And when they did that, they found that Canada was the second most expensive in the world. This is a completely ridiculous comparison. I don't think, certainly a first-year student wouldn't be able to get away with this at any university, because the United States, which has the most expensive healthcare system in the world, is also pretty much the youngest of the industrialized countries. On the other hand, Japan is the oldest of the industrialized countries, and they're spending only 8% of their economy on healthcare, one of the lowest of any developed country. So there's no international relationship at all between aging of the population and healthcare costs. That's my only guess as to how Mr. Manley could have said what he did say. But I think it is worth noting that people who you somehow expect from their titles to know what they're talking about, I find really don't have a clue in this area. And you mentioned the TD study earlier, which forecast that Ontario health spending would be 70 or 80% of Ontario program spending by the year 2030. There's absolutely no validity that me and any of my colleagues can see for these kinds of assertions. It's essentially taking what I said was a flat piece of data for 6 years, and then just without any rationalization, running it up vertically.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it seems that the Globe made some interesting choices in the people that they decided to quote and the studies that they decided to quote. Do you feel that the series did enough to be balanced on this issue?
I think the first thing I would say is that like many long series in newspapers, and the Globe in their remake this fall is now going for these, you know, week-long series of things, I'm finding just in general they're not very analytic. That they end up covering a lot of territory. The work is done by different reporters. They don't typically have editors who really know the area well enough to put all these disparate stories into any focus. So, I tend to find that conspiracies are very uncommon. They need to be well organized. I think the Globe's reporting was just sort of a bit of a dog's breakfast, with most of the stories having a perspective that we're in terrible trouble with our health system and we need to think of the private sector. But on the other hand, an article that they ran on Wednesday featured public sector solutions, and particularly the web edition of that article highlighted a number of examples that I've cited myself across the country of innovation in the public system.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it was so much that they deliberately were going to tar the public system. Mm-hmm. I think they just didn't really know the area that well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that something that Canadians may not realize, that 30% of our healthcare expenditures are actually private expenditures. I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about what that 30% is and whether it's important that Canadians know that amount.
Well, yes, we tend to think that we refer to our system all the time as not only public but government-run, when in fact, of course, most of the people actually administering the system are private but not-for-profit entities like physicians and hospitals, etc. So that about 30% of what we spend on healthcare in Canada does go through either private insurance, about half of it, or out of people's pockets. Ontario does have generous coverage for drugs for people over 65, but until you're 65, they only have a catastrophic program that doesn't kick in until, you know, you've really spent a lot of money. Just as an example, I spend over $3,000 a year for medication for a variety of chronic problems, and I don't have any public coverage. And dental care is the other big area. When our healthcare system was designed, in fact, Justice Emmett Hall, who chaired the 1964 Royal Commission on Health Services, recommended a dental program for children. That never was picked up. Canadians are covered for dental care that takes place in hospital, but these days very little dental care is required to be performed in a hospital. And the other areas that are big ones are optical care, eyeglasses, eye exams, and home care services, depending on your province, much of which can be has to be paid for privately.
Mm-hmm. So in the model that's being proposed by several prominent Canadian physicians and also in the globe, I guess, are people's experience with, like, say, the dental system or the optical system, is this the kind of experience that people would expect if these models were followed through with?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think at one level, I think that we all know that the best way to really see somebody's class of origin is to look at their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of research to back this up, that poor kids in this country just don't get the proper dental care that they need. And if they're not fortunate enough to, you know, live in an area where their water is fluoridated, then in fact they can end up with terrible lifelong dental problems before they're adults. And we know that you know, there's lots of people who can't afford the eyewear that they need and other. So there's lots of evidence to show that in those areas which are not covered by Medicare, we've got the same problems that the U.S. has for hospital and care and physician services. We've got a lot of people who can't afford to get the care that they need,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time, the overhead expenditures of running the private insurance plans in Canada is typically 5 to 10 times higher than that to run Medicare. In the U.S., their administration for their overall health program is also very expensive. So less equity, higher overhead costs, that's exactly what Medicare was brought in to deal with in terms of hospital and physician services. And as I mentioned, I think it's worth remembering that the original vision for Medicare included a lot more than what we've got now, and certainly included a much broader coverage for drugs and dental services.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the original vision of Medicare, there's some people who argue that Medicare worked in another time, but that it's not very practical in the 21st century. How did we get where we are now, and is it practical?
That's a great question. I think that many people think that our Medicare system was somehow designed by Tommy Douglas and you know, like out of a black and white movie, and that's why it doesn't work very well, because it's ancient. I think most people don't realize that in fact what we have now is very much a compromise from Douglas's original ideas. Tommy Douglas, Premier of Saskatchewan in the 40s and 50s, and then leader of the New Democratic Party federally in the 60s, championing Medicare both within Saskatchewan and then at the national level. He always said that our Medicare system would be implemented in two stages. The first would be public payment for the old system, which he referred to as being based on treating illness, and he said that the second stage of Medicare would be a new way of delivering services focused on keeping people healthy. And that's we have never followed through with that original vision of Medicare. We didn't even cover all the previously privately provided services. We didn't cover drugs. We didn't cover dental services. And we ended up with a delivery system that was very much what we had in the 50s. A family physician working in an office with a few other family doctors, with a non-professionally trained receptionist, no electronic health systems, and not being able to provide the care that people need if they're going to stay healthy and stay out of hospital. So I like to refer to the fact that the good parts of Medicare, the fact that everybody is covered for hospitals and physician services, and that our costs are much, much better controlled than in the United States, those good things happen when we listen to Tommy Douglas. The problems we have in our system, such as inefficient service delivery, lack of access to care, etc., those problems occurred when we didn't listen to Tommy Douglas and we didn't reform our delivery system.
I guess some of the things I've heard recently on the pro-private side are that people deserve a choice. And it seems like this has been parroted a lot, that people who can pay should be given the choice, and that this would benefit everyone, actually, because wait times would decrease, financial burden on the system would be alleviated. Is there any evidence that this is actually true, that both sides would benefit here?
There's a lot of evidence, but it all goes the other way and proves that those claims are false. That first of all, I should say that at the present time there is no restriction in most provinces on somebody setting up their own parallel healthcare system. So if you say you want to pay for your own care, that's fine. You know, finance your own hospitals, pay for your own doctors, and you can have that care. But the truth of it is that no private system is going to be effective unless two conditions are met. First of all, where the public system has to be perceived as being inadequate, and secondly, the private system has got to be subsidized by the public system. So that I don't object if people want their own completely private system that they're willing to pay for privately, but what happens is that people are always talking about, oh, well, we'll have doctors work the mornings in the public system and then they can work in the afternoons in the private system. And any time you try for these kinds of hybrid models, the private system parasitizes the public system. In most of the world, you've got public systems that are supposedly available in the mornings, and I've visited them in Dominican Republic and in Brazil, and on the ground, many of these doctors aren't even there in the morning, and they're rushing to their afternoon clinics. And plus, they will also make the offer to patients in the public system if they feel they can afford to pay them privately, that if you want faster care, come to see me in my private office. And in fact, that's exactly what was documented was being done in Ontario before we banned the practice of extra billing where doctors could bill their patients above the Medicare tariff. You actually had documented situations where doctors were telling their patients in public clinics, the wait is going to be a few months for me in the public clinic to get your operation. Come and see me in my private office. And even though I'll do you in the same operating room, it's going to you can get your service faster if you pay me extra. So these are not the solutions. And quite frankly, when we look at the solutions that are available, examples of best practices across Canada that show that we can, in fact, dramatically improve access and reduce costs at the same time if we follow Tommy Douglas's original vision for the second stage of Medicare.
I want to get to some of your ideas, the ideas that you have for improving the health system. So I wonder if you could outline some of those.
Well, they're based on that Tommy Douglas vision, and I would certainly say there's nothing wrong with that original vision of Medicare. It's solid. We just didn't implement it. So that means, for example, as Douglas called himself, he called for the creation of clinics where doctors would be working with other professionals, where there would be a focus on better managing people, for example, with chronic diseases like diabetes, so that they didn't develop complications and require hospital care. So those are all examples of moves on the second stage of Medicare. And I would say furthermore that we know this is something that's come really up in the last 10 to 20 years, that the quality, overall quality in our system is not what it should be. Whether we look in hospitals where roughly 5 to 10% of all deaths in Canada and other developed countries are due to preventable deaths that occur in hospitals, and we know that there are quality problems in nursing homes. I've mentioned quality problems in primary health care, the failure to better manage diabetes, for example, to prevent complications. So we've got all sorts of quality problems. And in health care, there's something developed in the last 15 years or so. It's often referred to as the quality agenda to focus on quality of care, patient outcomes, the patient experience. And by improving those metrics, one can lead to one develop a more sustainable system. So this is everything from structures in the system like out-of-hospital surgical facilities that are run by the public sector, such as the Queensway Surgery Center in Etobicoke, which is the largest out-of-hospital surgical center in North America, all the way to ensuring that we provide more sensitive patient-centered care so that we really listen to patients and their families when they come into the office, so we're sure that we know what they think their problems are and we can help them address them. Just parenthetically, the kinds of signs you see in many doctors' offices these days, one visit, one problem, is just the antithesis of good quality. So I think that if we follow Douglas's original values, then we look to some of the modern ideas of how to enhance quality in our health system, we'll find that, in fact, there already are the solutions available. They're all around us.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly, have you read any of the responses to the Globe pieces?
I did read some of the comments, but I must say maybe it's just my jaded older eyes that sometimes I find it hard to read comments through stories because it seems like there are so many just angry people out there who have nothing better to do with their days than write nasty comments. Mm-hmm. So I didn't read it thoroughly. Did you have something particular you were wondering about?
No, I'm just, from the stuff that I've read, it seems that Canadians are still staunchly behind their Medicare, and I wonder if you agree with that.
I completely agree with that. I make between 50 and 70 presentations a year all over the country to all sorts of different groups, and I find that Canadians want to love their Medicare,
mm-hmm.
but they keep on being told, oh, that's so old-fashioned, or, you know, you have to think of the discipline of the market,
mm-hmm.
and they're really kind of wondering, but I love my Medicare, can't I love my Medicare, and my arguments give them reasons to love their Medicare system and to defend it, so in a sense, I suppose I'm having deliberative dialogues with my audiences, and once they can get the information that, you know, as we talked at the beginning, healthcare costs are not out of control, and that, in fact, if anything, what's wrong with our public healthcare system is that it's not public enough, then I find Canadians are really happy to hear this news, and I agree with you, happy to get behind their Medicare system. Only about 25% or so of Canadians never really wanted Medicare, and they still don't like Medicare, but they seem to be the people who own the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Reckless.
Thank you very much for your interest.
All right. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to go to a quick song now. Arcade Fire, No Cars Go. All right, that was a little bit of Arcade Fire, No Cars Go. Before that, we were speaking with Michael Reckless. He's an associate professor at the University of Toronto. And we were talking about healthcare and the big debate, private versus public. You can read some of what he was talking about, see some figures, look at his work. His website is michaelreckless.com, michaelreckless.com. We're the Health Justice Radio Collective. I'm Nikki, and at the boards is Eric Brown. Thanks for joining us.